I want you to imagine just for a moment that you've been summoned for jury duty.
Oh, always a fun scenario to start with.
Right. But, you know, this isn't your average local courthouse.
Yeah.
And you aren't here to like deliberate on a white collar crime or traffic violation or something.
Yeah, the stakes are a little higher here.
Way higher. You are walking into a cosmic courtroom. And the case on the docket is, well, it's nothing less than the origin of your own
Which
existence.
is a huge thing to wrap your head around.
It is. So the prosecution stands up to present the evidence, and they don't use flashy rhetoric. They just use raw mathematics.
Hard numbers.
Exactly. First, they point out that the odds of just a single functional protein forming by unguided chemical chance are, you know, astronomically low.
Right.
And then the odds of the entire suite of biological machinery forming by chance, they calculate that at 1 in 10 to the power of 354.
Yeah, and to put that in perspective for you, I mean, there are only about 10 to the power of 80 atoms in the entire observable universe.
Wait, only 10 to the 80.
Yeah, so you could literally take every single atom in the universe, right,
Right.
and turn each one into a chemical laboratory running a million experiments a second for 14 billion years.
Oh,
And
wow.
you still wouldn't even scratch the surface of that probability. It's mathematically impossible.
That's just mind-bending. And so then the prosecution in this cosmic courtroom pivots to the universe itself.
Right, the fine-tuning of physics.
Yeah, they demonstrate that the physical constants of reality, things like the force of gravity, the electromagnetic force, the expansion rate of space, they're fine-tuned to a precision of 1 part in 10 to the power of 120.
Which is another one of those numbers that's just impossible to visualize.
Right. So they look at you, the jury, and they ask a very simple question. If the numbers are this deeply mathematically stacked against random chance, like what happens when the naturalistic worldview is pushed completely into a corner?
Yeah, when standard observable science just runs out of statistical runway,
Hmm.
how does the defense explain your existence?
Exactly. What is their alibi?
Well, they have to get incredibly creative. And frankly, they have to abandon standard empirical science to do it.
Because the numbers are just too big to ignore.
Right. When you face probabilities like 1 in 10 to the 354th power, you are no longer dealing with a scientific unknown. You're dealing with a mathematical impossibility.
Yeah.
So the defense team in this courtroom has to invent like an entirely new framework of reality just to explain away the evidence.
And that framework is exactly what we are putting on the stand today. We're doing a deep dive into the arguments presented in Mohammad Tariq Arbab's dissertation, The Origin Enigma.
Specifically, we're looking at chapter 6 today.
Right, sections 6.1 through 6.7. Our mission today is really clear. We're going to cross-examine the ultimate escape route that modern materialist science tries to use when faced with our highly improbable existence.
The
I'm
multiverse.
talking about the
Yeah.
multiverse,
Yeah.
yes. And, you know, we should probably set the terms of this discussion right away.
Yeah, because we need to be clear. This is not going to be a casual pop culture chat about comic book alternate realities.
Right, where you like wear a different colored shirt in another dimension.
Exactly. Or sci-fi dimensions where dinosaurs still rule the Earth. We aren't talking about cinematic universes here.
No, we are conducting a really rigorous forensic audit of a cosmological model.
Right. We are going to evaluate the multiverse hypothesis not as a proven physical reality, because let's be clear, it is completely unobservable.
Totally.
We're evaluating it as a philosophical alibi. It's an alibi that, according to the source text we're diving into, actually mathematically and logically destroys the very empirical foundations of science itself.
And before we bring the multiverse up to the witness stand, I feel like we need to establish the ground rules of this courtroom. Like, how do we even define science in the first place?
That is the crucial question, because the word gets thrown around a lot as a shield.
Yeah, it does. The source text argues that we've arrived at this metaphysical fork in the road. Science has systematically eliminated chance and physical necessity as viable explanations for life.
Which is a realization a lot of people haven't caught up to yet. For decades, the public has just been told that given enough time, and the right chemical soup, life is just inevitable.
Right, the primordial soup theory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But thermodynamics and chemical kinetics tell a completely different story. Amino acids in a primordial soup don't just naturally link up into complex information-bearing proteins.
In fact, doesn't water actually break those bonds apart?
Yes, water breaks those peptide bonds down in a process called hydrolysis. The natural tendency of unguided chemistry is to degrade into tar and asphalt, not to climb Mount Improbable and build a living cell.
So we arrive at this fork in the road, and I think the text frames it so beautifully. On one path, you follow the evidence where it actually leads, which is an inference of intelligent design.
Right. You find specified complexity, like the digital code in DNA, that mindless chemistry literally cannot produce. So you infer a mind.
But on the other path, if a scientist wants to, you know, avoid that inference at all costs, strict naturalism is basically forced to invoke unobservable infinities.
And to really understand how mainstream science ended up choosing that second path, we have to unpack a really critical distinction.
Okay, let's get into it.
It's the difference between methodological naturalism and philosophical naturalism. This is where the definition of science gets dangerously blurred.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second here. Isn't naturalism just another word for science? Like, the whole point of science is studying the natural world, right? We don't just write, "a wizard did it," in our lab reports.
No, we don't. And that is exactly what methodological naturalism is. And it is a brilliant, highly successful working assumption for the laboratory.
Okay.
It's the pragmatic rule that says when we do operational science, we look for physical, repeatable, natural causes.
Right. So if a chemist is in the lab analyzing a reaction, they assume the outcome is governed by physical laws. Electron
right.
valence, thermodynamics, kinetics, stuff like that.
Exactly. They don't assume a ghost intervened to change the pH of their solution. It's a tool, a heuristic. And it works beautifully for studying ongoing, reproducible phenomena in the present.
So it's like a set of rules for a specific game. If you're studying how a combustion engine works, you look at the spark plugs and the fuel injectors. You don't look for magic.
Precisely. But philosophical naturalism is something entirely different. It is not a scientific method at all.
What is it, then?
It is a rigid metaphysical worldview. It is the unbending belief that matter and energy are absolutely all that exists in reality. Period.
So there's no room for anything else?
None. Under this worldview, the mind, consciousness, and intelligence are all just like late evolutionary accidents produced by blind matter.
Wow.
And the text makes a really strong case that philosophical naturalism has basically hijacked methodological naturalism. The philosophy has disguised itself as the scientific method.
Let me try a different analogy here to ground this for you, taking it out of the lab and into forensics. Let's say methodological naturalism is like an FBI forensic team searching a crime scene exclusively for physical evidence.
Right, like fingerprints, DNA, hair follicles, chemical residue.
Exactly. That is just good, solid police work. You want your investigators doing that to reconstruct the physical events of the crime.
You absolutely do.
But philosophical naturalism, that is, that's an FBI director who walks into a perfectly coordinated, masterfully executed bank heist.
Okay.
The vault has been blown with millimeter precision. Security cameras have been hacked to loop fake footage. And the laser grid was bypassed using a highly complex algorithm.
A real Ocean's 11 situation.
Exactly. And this director looks at all of it and declares, because my forensic toolkit only allows me to measure physical footprints and chemical explosive residue, I absolutely refuse to believe a conscious mastermind planned this.
Right. The wind must have blown the vault door open and a random power surge hacked the cameras.
Exactly. It stops being a useful investigative tool and becomes an absolute blindfold.
That is a phenomenal encapsulation of the problem. And if we look at other branches of historical science, the double standard becomes glaringly obvious.
Oh, yeah. The source text brings up archaeology and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI.
Yes. In both of those fields, the entire scientific enterprise is built around detecting the markers of intelligent design.
This is one of my favorite points in the text. Let's look at SETI for a second. If researchers point a massive radio telescope at a distant star system and they pick up a signal that pulses in a sequence of prime numbers like 2, 3, 5, 7, 11,
right.
They don't publish a paper saying, wow, what a fascinating random fluctuation of cosmic dust.
No, the immediate universally accepted scientific inference would be that a conscious alien mind produced that signal.
Right.
Why? Because prime numbers exhibit what information theorists call specified complexity. It's a highly improbable pattern that conforms to an independent functional requirement. The laws of physics just do not generate prime numbers. Minds do.
Or think of archaeology. If you're digging in the desert and you find a piece of flint that looks exactly like a carved arrowhead, I mean, it's functionally shaped, it has a notch to be tied to a shaft, it's aerodynamic.
Yeah, you immediately infer a human designer. You don't assume that a river magically eroded the rock into a perfect weapon over millions of years.
Because that violates uniform human experience. We apply the vera causa principle, the principle of a true cause. We know from observed experience that intelligent agents create functionally specified tools.
Exactly. We have never seen erosion create an arrowhead.
But, and here is where the courtroom drama really heats up. When molecular biology looks inside the living cell, what do they find?
They find actual, literal digital code in DNA.
Yes. Three-letter codons spelling out instructions for proteins. They find error-correcting enzymes that literally proofread the code.
Automated transcription machines.
They find irreducible rotary motors, like the bacterial flagellum. But suddenly, applying the exact same logic we use for the arrowhead or the SETI signal is deemed unscientific by philosophical naturalists.
It is an astounding methodological inconsistency. To accept the design inference for a chip piece of stone or a radio blip, but entirely exclude it when faced with the nanotechnology and semantic information of the biological realm.
Which vastly exceeds the complexity of our most advanced supercomputers, by the way.
Right. Doing that is the definition of special pleading. The author insists that the design inference isn't a departure from science. It is standard historical science based on empirical observation.
We know intelligence causes digital code.
Therefore, inferring intelligence when we find digital code in biology is following the evidence, not abandoning it.
So once you, the listener, understand that absolute naturalism is a philosophical choice, like it's a worldview constraint and not a strictly scientific mandate, then we can truly examine what happens when this worldview is backed into a corner.
Yeah, when it runs out of options.
Exactly. When philosophical naturalism is confronted with the impossible odds of a fine-tuned universe and the thermodynamic barriers of unguided chemistry, it desperately needs an alibi. And its primary alibi is the multiverse.
Right.
Let's put the multiverse on the stand.
Let's do it. And let's remind ourselves of the sheer scale of the problem naturalism is trying to escape here. In cosmology, you have the cosmological constant.
Okay, remind me what that is.
This relates to the energy density of the vacuum of space, which drives the expansion of the universe. It is fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the power of 120.
That's the one we mentioned earlier.
Yes. If it were slightly larger, the universe would have blown apart so fast that galaxies and stars could never form. If it were slightly smaller, gravity would have crushed the universe back in on itself in a fraction of a second.
And just to be clear, 10 to the 120th power isn't a number we can easily comprehend.
Yeah.
If you had a tape measure stretching across the entire observable universe and you had to place a pin on one specific microscopic inch mark, that is the level of precision we're talking about.
And that is just one physical constant. Then, over in biology, you have the biological probability deficit. The cumulative probability of unguided chemical evolution producing a living cell on Earth is calculated at 10 to the power of -354.
Right.
These numbers represent functional, physical impossibilities within a single finite universe. So naturalism plays its biggest and really its only remaining card.
And the logic goes something like this. Sure, our universe looks impossibly rigged for life, the numbers are absurd, but what if there are an infinite number of universes?
What if there's a cosmic slot machine pulling the lever forever?
Exactly. If you roll the cosmic dice an infinite number of times, then an incredibly improbable, fine-tuned, life-permitting universe like ours isn't just possible, it becomes absolutely inevitable.
That is the core argument of the multiverse hypothesis. But the source text forensically dismantles why this is scientifically and philosophically ruinous.
Where does it fall apart first?
First, just on a basic philosophical level, postulating an infinite number of completely unobservable, empirically inaccessible universes just to explain the one single universe we can observe is the greatest violation of Occam's razor in the history of science.
Occam's razor being the principle that the simplest explanation, the one that requires the fewest assumptions, is usually the right one.
Exactly. It tells us not to multiply entities unnecessarily. The multiverse commits catastrophic explanatory bloat. You are inventing infinite, invisible, untouchable realities specifically to avoid the teleological implications of the reality sitting right in front of you.
The text brings in a concept from philosopher Ian Hacking called the inverse gambler's fallacy, which I think perfectly illustrates why this leap in logic is so deeply broken.
Oh, this is a great analogy.
The classic casino analogy is often used here, but let's update it for a modern context. Think about procedural generation in video games or AI.
Okay.
Imagine you boot up a new game that randomly generates a completely unique digital universe every time you play. You hit start, and the very first planet you spawn on happens to be an exact one-to-one, molecularly perfect replica of Earth.
Complete with your house and everything.
Right. complete with a digital replica of your house, your family, and a book on the table that contains the exact text of every conversation you've ever had.
The odds of a random number generator producing that specific, highly ordered data set on the first try are essentially zero.
Exactly. Now, the inverse gambler's fallacy would be you sitting in your chair and saying, wow, the odds of this procedural generation happening by chance are so low. There must be billions of other people playing this game in invisible rooms all over the world right now.
Because if billions of other people are playing, it makes my randomly generated replica Earth statistically inevitable.
Which is logically absurd.
Completely absurd.
The rational, logical inference isn't to invent invisible players to justify the chance. The logical inference is that the game is rigged. The code was intentionally written to put you there. A programmer designed that specific outcome.
And if we extrapolate that fallacy back to cosmology, this raises a devastating question about the very nature of scientific evidence.
How so?
Well, think about it. If any highly specified, functionally complex, wildly improbable phenomenon can just be waved away by saying, well, we live in an infinite multiverse, so it was bound to happen somewhere in infinity, and we just happen to be the ones observing it. Then what happens to science?
It dies. It completely halts all genuine scientific inquiry.
Precisely. You never have to actually explain how anything works mechanically, or why it originated. Why did the bacterial flagellum appear? Multiverse chance.
Why does the semantic code of DNA exist? Multiverse chance.
Why did the Big Bang have such low entropy? Multiverse chance. It is a universal get-out-of-jail-free card. It destroys the empirical foundation of science, which relies on seeking specific, verifiable causal mechanisms.
But let's say a committed materialist bites that bullet. Let's say they accept the explanatory bloat because they just really, really hate the idea of a designer. The text shows that they don't just run into philosophical problems, right?
Oh, no, it gets much worse for them.
Because when theoretical physicists actually attempt to do the math on infinite universes, the entire mathematical equation of reality collapses.
This brings us to a massively important concept known in theoretical physics as the measure problem. The measure problem is the mathematical Achilles heel of the multiverse hypothesis, and it fundamentally breaks the concept of probability itself.
Okay, I'm going to push back here because this seems counterintuitive to me. In higher mathematics, we deal with infinity all the time. Calculus uses limits that approach infinity to find the area under a curve. Physicists use infinities. Why can't we just calculate the probability of life in an infinite multiverse? Why does the math suddenly break?
That is a great question. The infinities in calculus are rigorously defined limits, but the infinity in a cosmological multiverse involves infinite sets of discrete events, and that leads to paradoxes that cannot be regularized.
Okay, unpack that for me.
In any normal finite framework, probability is very simple to calculate. It's the number of favorable outcomes divided by the total number of possible outcomes. If you have a finite set, you can do the math. But in a truly infinite multiverse, this standard formula completely breaks down into a mathematically undefined operation.
Let me try to make this math relatable because my mind was bending when I was reading this section. Let's say I have a bag of marbles. Three of them are red, seven are blue, 10 total. The chance of me blindly pulling a red marble is 3/10, 30%. Easy. You, the listener, do this kind of math in your head at the grocery store.
Right.
But now, let's say the multiverse is true. That means I have an infinite number of red marbles representing life-permitting universes and an infinite number of blue marbles representing dead universes. Now, what is the probability of pulling a red one?
You literally cannot calculate it.
Exactly. It is infinity divided by infinity. If you type that into a calculator, it gives you an error. It is mathematically undefined. Furthermore, depending on the arbitrary way you decide to group or measure the marbles, which is where the term measure problem comes from, you can make the probability exactly zero, exactly 100%, or anywhere in between.
Because in infinite set theory, you can map infinite subsets in contradictory ways. And this causes a total epistemological collapse.
What does that mean for the theory, practically?
For a scientific theory to be valid, it must make specific, falsifiable predictions. A cosmological model needs to be able to say, if this theory is true, we should expect to see outcome X, and we should definitely not see outcome Y.
Right.
But if your theory predicts that literally every physically possible outcome happens an infinite number of times, it predicts absolutely nothing. It cannot be constrained by any observation whatsoever.
So no matter what bizarre phenomenon you observe in the universe, you can just say, well, that's what happens in this particular pocket of the infinite multiverse.
Exactly. It becomes completely unfalsifiable. It's pseudoscience at that point.
The author cites Paul Steinhardt to drive this point home, right? And Steinhardt is not a minor figure or an intelligent design advocate.
No, not at all. Steinhardt was one of the original architects of inflationary cosmology, which is the very mechanism that is often used to mathematically generate the multiverse.
Huh?
And Steinhardt himself concluded that because the multiverse explained everything, it explains nothing. He stated that it is rendered completely useless as a predictive scientific model. It's a mathematical dead end.
Okay, so dividing infinity by infinity is a massive mathematical headache. But let's keep pressing the defense in our courtroom. Because if you think the measure problem is bad, wait until we look at what the multiverse does manage to predict if you force the issue of thermodynamics.
Yes.
This brings us to what is honestly the most bizarre, mind-bending, and damning witness in this entire deep dive. The Boltzmann brain paradox.
The Boltzmann brain paradox is the ultimate reductio ad absurdum of the multiverse hypothesis. It takes the premise of an infinite, randomly fluctuating multiverse and rigorously follows it to its logical, inescapable, and utterly absurd conclusion based on the laws of thermodynamics.
Before we explain the brains, we need to explain the physics behind them. Who is Boltzmann and what does thermodynamics have to do with floating brains?
Ludwig Boltzmann was a brilliant 19th century physicist who pioneered statistical mechanics. He was trying to explain the second law of thermodynamics, the rule that the universe tends toward entropy or disorder.
Okay.
Boltzmann proposed that perhaps the universe as a whole is in a state of thermal equilibrium, essentially a dead, chaotic soup. But in an infinitely old, endlessly large space, random thermal and quantum fluctuations will occasionally happen.
Like ripples on the surface of a pond.
Exactly. And given infinite time, those random fluctuations will eventually arrange matter into low entropy, highly ordered states, purely by statistical chance. He used this to explain why our universe has low entropy right now. We're just living in the aftermath of a massive, incredibly rare thermal fluctuation.
Okay, so modern multiverse theorists take Boltzmann's idea of infinite time and infinite space, and they apply it to the infinite bubble universes popping into existence. Infinity guarantees that everything physically possible will spontaneously assemble itself at some point.
Correct. But here is where the trap closes on the materialist. The text lays out a brutal logical comparison based on the math of entropy. What is physically easier, and therefore statistically far more likely, for a random quantum fluctuation to spontaneously produce?
Okay, give me the options.
Option A, an entire highly ordered universe with trillions of galaxies, billions of years of coherent history, low entropy, and stable physical laws that allow complex biological evolution over deep time.
Right.
Or option B, a single disembodied conscious brain floating in a vacuum for a fraction of a millisecond, complete with fake hallucinatory memories of a past that never actually happened just before it dissolves back into the void.
It's so wild. We need a really modern metaphor for this because the old analogies don't quite capture the horror of this. Think about generative AI. Think about asking an AI image generator to create a picture.
Oh, that's a good way to frame it.
Right. What requires more processing power, more code, and more specific anti-entropic order? Mm. Asking the AI to generate a single static image of a living room that looks incredibly realistic, but is actually full of errors if you look closely, books with gibberish titles, weird shadows.
Yeah.
Or asking the AI to program an entire functional, perfectly simulated 3D virtual reality world with consistent physics, billions of NPCs with complete backstories, and a 14 billion year simulated history.
The single static image requires vastly less order and vastly less information.
Obviously. So translating that back to the physics of the multiverse, the thermodynamic math dictates that a fluctuation creating a single brain with fake memories is astronomically, unimaginably more likely than a fluctuation creating a genuine, massive, ancient universe.
Right.
Therefore, the multiverse hypothesis predicts that the vast, overwhelming majority of observers out there are not real people living in real universes. They are just single, floating Boltzmann brains that popped into existence with a fake set of memories.
That is exactly the inescapable mathematical prediction of the multiverse. Thermodynamics strongly favors the simpler, more localized structure, the single brain. By a margin so large, it dwarfs the number of atoms in reality.
So wait, if we follow the logic of the multiverse to its necessary conclusion...
You, the listener, are statistically almost certainly a Boltzmann brain.
You are hallucinating this deep dive.
You are hallucinating your memories of childhood, The room you are sitting in, the air you are breathing, and the laws of physics you think govern your life.
None of it is real.
It's all just a momentary thermal fluctuation in an infinite void.
And you will cease to exist in the next millisecond.
Which is existentially terrifying, but also kind of hilarious when you realize this is the corner materialist science has painted itself into.
It is deeply absurd, but it has a very serious, fatal scientific consequence. Because we don't observe a chaotic void.
We don't experience reality as a fleeting hallucination before dissolving into thermal equilibrium. We observe a highly coherent, ancient, mathematically lawful universe. We observe a reality that is shared by other observers, where the laws of physics are stable.
And the fact that our lived empirical reality is coherent fundamentally falsifies the multiverse model.
Exactly. The multiverse firmly predicts chaotic absurdity and fake observers. We observe ordered reality and genuine history. Therefore, the theory contradicts the observation. The Boltzmann brain paradox isn't just a fun thought experiment for stoners at 2 a.m.
Right. It is a fatal empirical blow to the multiverse as a scientific hypothesis.
It really is.
I love how the text uses the multiverse's own internal logic to destroy itself. But let's keep playing devil's advocate. Let's pretend none of that happened.
Okay, moving the goalposts.
Let's say we ignore the measure problem and the broken math. Let's say theoretical physicists find some magical cutoff rule to get rid of the floating hallucinatory brains.
Generous of us.
Very generous. If we grant the existence of the multiverse, does it actually solve the fine-tuning problem? Does it explain why the physical constants are so perfectly calibrated for life? Or does it just sweep the problem under a larger cosmic rug?
That brings us to what the text calls the ultimate evasion, fine-tuning the generator. This is where the defense's case completely unravels.
Tell me about the generator.
Even if we grant, purely for the sake of argument, that a multiverse exists, we have to ask a very basic causal question. How did it get there? A multiverse requires a physical mechanism to generate it.
Yeah.
It doesn't just exist by magic.
Right.
Whether theoretical physicists are talking about eternal inflation or colliding brains in higher dimensional space or the string theory landscape, these are physical processes. They are governed by physical laws and mathematical equations.
Right. It's not just poof. Infinite universes. There has to be a machine pumping them out. Let's pretend there's a cosmic factory out there, an infinite bubble universe generator constantly spitting out new realities.
Well,
the crucial, unavoidable question is, who built the factory? Doesn't a factory that complex need perfectly tuned gears, precise energy inputs, and highly specific laws just to operate without blowing itself up or churning out dead radioactive garbage?
Yes, and that is exactly what the physics of multiverse theories demand. The multiverse generator itself must be exquisitely calibrated.
Give me an example.
Let's look at the actual physics of eternal inflation, which is the most popular multiverse model. It relies on something called an inflatten field, a hypothetical scalar field that drives exponential expansion.
Okay, I'm with you.
For eternal inflation to work, the potential energy curve of this field has to be incredibly specific. If the decay rate of the false vacuum to the true vacuum is slightly off, the expanding bubble universes will constantly collide and annihilate each other before any stars or life can ever form.
Wow.
Or consider string theory. For the string theory landscape to produce universes, the fundamental string tension and the exact ways the extra dimensions fold in on themselves, the Galabiel manifolds, have to be precisely constrained.
What happens if they aren't?
If string tension is too high, the vacuum of space destabilizes instantly. The physical mechanism that produces universes is itself subject to severe, highly improbable fine-tuning.
So the multiverse doesn't actually get rid of the fine-tuning problem at all. It just relocates it. It shifts the fine-tuning up one level.
Exactly.
Instead of having to explain a fine-tuned universe, now the naturalist has to explain a massively fine-tuned multiverse generator. You haven't solved the mystery of the bank heist. You've just discovered that the bank robbers used a highly advanced, custom-built helicopter to get away. And now you have to explain who built the helicopter.
You've kicked the can down an infinite road. The causal regress does not terminate in a satisfying, unguided, naturalistic explanation. It terminates in a further more complex layer of fine-tuning that requires the exact same teleological explanation, the exact same need for a designer as the original problem.
That's incredible.
The author walks the reader through what is beautifully termed the logical terminus. It is the point in this forensic audit where all the naturalistic escape routes are officially and irreversibly closed.
Let's review the lockdown. The ontological route fails because of Occam's razor and catastrophic explanatory bloat.
The probabilistic route fails because of the measure problem. dividing infinity by infinity.
The physical route fails because it inevitably predicts Boltzmann brains, contradicting our lived reality.
And the causal route fails because the multiverse generator itself requires fine-tuning. The multiverse, as an alibi for naturalism, is a dead end.
The courtroom doors are locked. The alibi has completely fallen apart under cross-examination. So with the multiverse totally dismantled, strict naturalism has absolutely nowhere left to hide.
You're right.
The physical fine-tuning of the cosmos, the chemical hurdles of thermodynamics, the mathematical impossibility of unguided chance, the philosophy of science, it all points directly away from blind materialism.
It does.
So how do committed materialists deal with this checkmate? When the empirical evidence forces them into a corner, what do? Do they concede the case?
No. The source text reveals that their final maneuver is to simply declare the game over and flip the board.
Wow, and this introduces a vital philosophical concept, right?
Yes, the brute fact fallacy. Stripped of the multiverse, naturalism reaches what the author calls causal exhaustion. The materialist paradigm simply runs out of causal power.
It just hits a wall.
It cannot explain the low entropy initial conditions of the Big Bang. It cannot explain the precise tuning of a cosmological constant. And crucially, it cannot explain the origin of semantic digital biological code from chemical determinism.
So what do?
To avoid the design inference, to avoid ever having to utter the word design or acknowledge a mind-committed materialists commit a profound philosophical error. They invoke the brute fact fallacy.
Explain to the listener what that means in practical terms. What does it look like when a scientist commits this fallacy?
It means arbitrarily halting a scientific investigation by declaring a highly complex specified phenomenon to be an unexplainable axiom or a fundamental reality for no other reason than to avoid where the evidence is leading. You just shrug and say, it just is.
It just is. That's the scientific answer.
That's it. The text uses a brilliant, deeply technical example of this involving the work of an information theorist named Hubert Yahki.
I really want to unpack Yahki's argument here because when I read this section, my jaw hit the floor. It is wild.
Hubert Yahki was a rigorous scientist. He applied information theory directly to molecular biology, and he mathematically proved that the deterministic laws of physics and chemistry simply cannot generate the genetic code.
Okay, so he proved it mathematically.
Yes. He showed that the chemistry of DNA does not dictate the sequence of the bases, just like the chemistry of ink and paper doesn't dictate the words of a Shakespearean sonnet. He rigorously proved that unguided matter cannot write biological software.
So he proved exactly what this entire dissertation has been arguing. Blind matter cannot make code.
Right. He closed the door on chemical evolution. But instead of concluding teleology, instead of inferring intelligent design from his own mathematical proof, Yahki makes a staggering philosophical maneuver.
What does he do?
He invokes Gödel's incompleteness theorem from mathematics. Now, Kurt Gödel proved that in any sufficiently complex formal mathematical system, there will be true statements that cannot be proven from within the system itself. The system is incomplete.
Okay, I follow that.
Yahki takes this concept and applies it to the origin of life. He argues that the origin of biological information is an algorithmic undecidability. He essentially declares the origin of life is just an unexplainable axiom of nature. It's a brute fact.
Wait.
It exists. We know chemistry can't explain it, and we refuse to invoke a designer, so we just have to accept it as an inexplicable given.
I have to stop you right there, because that is unbelievable. So after rigorously mathematically proving that blind matter cannot write digital code, his grand scientific conclusion is just, it's a mystery we aren't allowed to solve.
That's what it boils down to.
Going back to our FBI analogy, that is like the lead investigator walking into the bank vault, finding a highly sophisticated, mathematically encrypted ransom note, proving definitively that the wind and the dust couldn't have randomly formed that exact pattern of ink, and then writing in his final official police report, the origin of this coded note is an algorithmic undecidability. It is an unexplainable axiom of the universe. Case closed.
Yeah.
That is not science. That is an intellectual surrender dressed up in incredibly fancy mathematical jargon.
That is exactly the author's critique, and it cuts to the bone of modern scientific philosophy. If empirical analysis demonstrates that biological information transcends the causal capacity of matter, declaring its origin inherently unknowable isn't a scientific conclusion.
No, it's a cop-out.
It is a rigid refusal to follow the evidence. It is an a priori commitment to a philosophical worldview over empirical truth.
And this is where we have to address the biggest, most common criticism thrown at the design inference. Whenever this topic comes up, critics always shout, oh, intelligent design is just a God of the gaps argument. You just don't know how chemistry did it yet, so you're inserting a miracle to cover your own scientific ignorance.
Right. You hear that all the time.
But the text argues the exact opposite.
Yes, and this point cannot be emphasized enough for anyone studying this field. The design inference is not an argument from ignorance. It is not based on what we don't know. It is an argument from positive empirical knowledge.
Explain that.
It relies on exactly what we do know about cause and effect in the universe. We have positive, exhaustive knowledge of what unguided chemistry can do. Thermodynamics and kinetics show us that unguided amino acids and sugars create tar, asphalt, and repetitive, low-information crystals. They do not create semantic digital code.
Right.
Conversely, we also have positive, uniform knowledge of what conscious intelligence can do. Intelligence writes digital code, builds irreducibly complex nanomachinery, and creates functionally specified information.
We see intelligence doing that every single day.
Yeah.
Every time a software engineer writes a program, every time an architect drafts a blueprint, we are observing the causal power of a mind to generate specified complexity.
Exactly. So when we look inside the living cell and find literal digital code, error-correcting algorithms, and complex nanomachinery, inferring that a mind is responsible is not a leap in the dark.
It's following the data.
It is the most rational, scientifically grounded inference based on our uniform experience of cause and effect. To refuse to follow the evidence to a designer isn't a scientific constraint. It is a philosophical blindfold. The brute fact fallacy is just a desperate attempt to permanently shield the materialist worldview from falsification.
This has been an absolutely relentless cross-examination. We have dragged the entire materialist paradigm into the light. Let's try to summarize the massive scope of what we've covered today in this cosmic courtroom.
Let's do it.
We started with the realization that naturalism is at a metaphysical fork in the road. Because chemistry and physics empirically fail to explain the origin of life, strict materialists have had to abandon methodological naturalism, the good empirical lab science for philosophical naturalism, a rigid, unprovable belief system.
And to protect that belief system from the impossible odds of cosmological fine-tuning and the chemical barriers to life, they invoke the ultimate escape route, the multiverse.
Hmm.
But as we've seen, the multiverse completely fails mathematically because of the measure problem.
Right. You cannot divide infinity by infinity and expect a predictive scientific model.
Exactly. It fails logically and empirically because of the Boltzmann brain paradox, inevitably predicting that you are a fleeting, chaotic hallucination rather than a real observer in an ordered reality.
And even if you ignore the broken math and the terrifying floating brains, the multiverse still fails causally because the generator itself, whether it's an inflaton field or string theory, requires exquisite fine-tuning just to operate.
It's a cosmic turtle on top of a turtle argument. All the escape routes are permanently closed.
And the final desperate gasp of the naturalistic defense is just to commit the brute fact fallacy, to declare the miracle of life an algorithmic undecidability and surrender intellectually, just to avoid saying the word design.
The overarching conclusion of this section of the text is incredibly powerful, and it completely reframes how we should view biological science. The scientific method, when applied consistently and stripped of philosophical bias, points to a single causally adequate hypothesis: intelligent design.
Because every digital code, every functional algorithm, and every symbolic language that human experience has ever documented traces back unequivocally to a conscious mind.
Yes. The genetic code inside your DNA is a literal semantic digital code. Therefore, the standard scientific inference conducted by the exact same logic used in forensic science, archaeology, or SETI is that the genetic code also traces back to a pre-existing mind.
It is an airtight forensic argument. It takes the very tools of logic, mathematics, and empirical science that materialists claim to champion and uses them to systematically dismantle the materialist worldview from the inside out.
Before we wrap up this session, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. We've spent this entire deep dive looking backward at the origin of the cosmos, the thermodynamics of the first cell, the incredibly improbable sequence of events that had to be authored by a mind just to get biological hardware to exist in the first place.
Yeah.
But I want you to think about the implications of that evidence for the present moment.
Where are you going with this?
If the cosmic architecture of the physical universe and the digital genetic code inside every single one of your cells, both mathematically and empirically, point to a pre-existing mind, does that mind still interact with the code today? If the universe went to such impossible, mind-bending lengths tuning the cosmological constant to 1 in 10 to the power of 120, writing gigabytes of error-corrected biological software, just to author the existence of life. What does that imply about the intrinsic value of the hardware sitting in the chair listening to this right now? If the universe isn't a blind, accidental, entropic void, is it still speaking?
Wow, that changes absolutely everything about how you look at the world around you. When you realize the math behind your own existence, you can never look at a tree or your own hand or the night sky the same way again.
It demands a complete paradigm shift.
Well, the jury is going to be deliberating on that for a long, long time. You've heard the evidence. You've seen the materialist alibi completely collapse under the weight of its own mathematical and logical absurdities. You've seen the fingerprints of a mastermind left at the scene of a cosmic crime. Now the verdict is up to you. Question your assumptions, look at the empirical evidence without the philosophical blindfolds, and keep diving deep into the true origins of reality. Thanks for joining us in the courtroom today. We'll see you on the next deep dive.